By listening to the Conscious Fertility Podcast, you agree to not use this podcast as medical advice to treat any medical condition in either yourself or others. Consult your own physician or healthcare provider for any medical issues that you may be having. This entire disclaimer also applies to any guests or contributors to the podcast. Welcome to Conscious Fertility, the show that listens to all of your fertility questions so that you can move from fear and suffering to peace of mind and joy. My name is Lauren Brown. I'm a doctor of traditional Chinese medicine and a clinical hypnotherapist. I'm on a mission to explore all the paths to peak fertility and joyful living. It's time to learn how to be and receive so that you can create life on purpose. We have Dr. Lara Bryden on the Conscious Fertility Podcast, and she's actually practiced, lives in New Zealand, but she is a fellow Canadian from Alberta, Canada. She is a naturopathic doctor and best-selling author of the books Period Repair Manual and Hormone Repair Manual, Practical Guides to Treating Period Problems with Nutrition, Supplements, and Bioidentical Hormones. And I'm so grateful to Lara because she was in Vancouver and did an integrative talk with our local naturopath, Kaylee McIsaac, and also Fiona McCulloch. And we started to give some of your books away as door prizes, and people are really appreciative of that as well. So thank you. She has a strong science background. Lara sits on several advisory boards and is the lead author on a couple of peer-reviewed papers as well. She has over 20 years' experience in women's health and currently has consulting rooms in New Zealand where she treats women with PCOS, PMS, endometriosis, perimenopause, and many other hormone and period-related health problems. Lara, I'm so glad that I get to talk to you here on our Conscious Fertility Podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Lauren. And of course, we got to meet in person last year, which was fun.
It was nice.
In this era of everything over Zoom and everything online, we got to do an online event.
It was nice. We had people online and we had people in the room with us. And that was, now it's getting a little more common. 2023 mm-hmm. as we record this.
Yeah.
It was nice to be in your mm-hmm. presence. Now, mm-hmm. I wanted to chat with you because you've written a lot about hormonal health and it's a big part of your practice. And I think about the women that we see and our approach are similar, our clinic and how you approach that, mm-hmm. A healthy cycle seems to be important, not just for people's well-being, but also to create a healthy baby and to optimize your fertility. I'm assuming you subscribe to that idea.
Oh, yeah. Although truthfully, I'll full disclosure, I don't treat a lot of fertility because I'll just tell you why, because female hormones are only one small part of that puzzle, as you know, egg quality, which relates to hormones, but there's immune function in the woman. And then there's all the whole male side of things, which is huge. So yes, I mean, I can slot in on the female hormone side of things, but it's always just one part of fertility.
That's why I wanted to talk to you is because when it comes to reproductive health, one of the things we look at is, do you have healthy hormonal cycles? Do you have balanced hormones? Because that's going to contribute to the environment that's going to support the maturation of the egg and it reaching its peak fertility potential. So what is considered a healthy cycle then? Because I see women saying, my cycle's normal. My medical doctor said my cycle's normal. And normal doesn't always mean healthy. So how would somebody know that they have hormonal problems then? Why do they seek you out?
Yeah, I think the first step is to reframe a cycle as an ovulatory cycle. So everyone thinks about the period as the main event of the menstrual cycle, but actually ovulation is the main event. And that's from a general health perspective, as well as obviously from a fertility perspective. But I don't know if people, your listeners, realize, but it's actually quite common to have what are called anovulatory cycles. So you could be even having semi-regular bleeds and potentially not ovulating at all, or having what's called subclinical ovulatory disturbance, where you maybe are ovulating, but you're not forming like a strong corpus luteum. You're not getting that robust luteal phase. So yeah, in answer to your question, the step one is to ask the question, am I ovulating with these cycles? And track that, preferably with temperatures. I'm guessing you've had guests before that talked about a bit about cycle tracking and using under the tongue temperatures for tracking ovulation. It's extremely helpful.
And then there's some urinary testing that you can do to test to see if you've ovulated. They look for the downstream metabolites of the progesterone, even like the
actual. Oh, yes. Actually, there are some progesterone urine tests. Yeah, I haven't used those clinically, but that's another option.
And there's blood tests. So, but you're saying just having a bleed although usually the doctors will say, if you're bleeding monthly, you're ovulating monthly, and you know through the research that you've been involved in, that sometimes you can have a bleed and it was a non-ovulatory bleed.
Exactly, anovulatory. So that some of that research is coming directly from your neighbor, scientist, Darlene Pryor,
right,
at CenCor, which is pretty close to you, actually, just a few blocks away. She did a study. She's a famous Canadian scientist, an expert on ovulation. She runs called the Center for Ovulation, Menstruation and Ovulation Research. And she discovered that it was close to like a third of cycles are anovulatory. They're invisible anovulatory cycles. And that's just in women who are basically healthy. But ovulation is one of the first things to go with health, right? Like ovulation is hard to do. So as soon as there's any kind of stress or even just like social stress or emotional stress or illness or nutrition not dialed in, ovulation slows down. It either stops, doesn't happen, or like I said, ovulation could happen, but not robustly. And a lot of that's to do with egg quality, right? Like that's to do with the formation of the corpus luteum, which is what makes progesterone, but all the kind of months leading up to that and the health of the follicles, the little baby eggs, the little baby follicles as they were on their, what I call 100 days to ovulation, on their journey to ovulation. They need to be fully nourished, have all the right hormonal signaling, including stress hormones and not too much inflammation and not too, you know, high insulin and all those things happening so that when one of them wins the race to ovulation and ovulates, that's a nice, strong follicle that forms a nice corpus luteum and makes lots of progesterone. That's what you want.
So I want to kind of unpack that a bit. What you shared is sort of that 100 days. So that follicular genesis, determining that egg quality, that last 100 days is that time when the follicle can reach its peak fertility potential. And the follicle is kind of, I've heard people call it like, it's the baby house. It's supporting the egg. So good mitochondrial health, good blood flow. Like you said, what's the blood sugar levels like? What's the hormonal signals like? Inflammation signals, nutritional profile. Here's something, Lara, I shared this once with a reproductive endocrinologist and they said it's theoretical. They said it makes sense. You know, we got to do more research because they didn't consider spotting an issue in the fertility, in the reproductive endocrinology. They're like, oh, luteal phase defect went out in the 80s. It's kind of to quote. And I know as a naturopathic physician, you don't want to see spotting. You look at that as a sign of an imbalance, right?
Correct. Yeah. I mean, there could be lots of reasons for it, but definitely. Yeah.
And so I said, well, here's my thought. And I came from a yin-yang Chinese medicine's perspective. Mm. So you got the egg and the follicle are one. They're together at one point in time. And then as you shared, the egg is released into the tube and the corpus luteum, the follicle becomes a corpus luteum. It produces progesterone. So one way to kind of assess the quality of the egg is if the corpus luteum cannot produce progesterone for those 14 days, or there's a lot of spotting, or you have that luteal phase defect. Well, since they were once one and it's the follicle that's charging, supporting the egg during those 100 days, then if the corpus luteum doesn't look great through how we're seeing progesterone, theoretically, I speculate that maybe the egg isn't great as it could be because it didn't have that great follicular support.
Yeah, that's exactly it. You articulated that very well. That's what I was sort of leaving unsaid to some extent. But yes, the journey of the follicles is going to result in both a healthy egg itself, and egg quality is important for fertility, and the corpus luteum that formed from the follicle that held the egg. Yeah, they're one and the same. I think that's
pretty. And progesterone is important because it helps with the window of implantation and maintains the lining. So I would like to talk, because I know we're short on time today for our interview, and I wanted to grab some really good pearls from you. The things that I think of where some of the hormonal imbalances are obvious are conditions like endometriosis and PCOS. And PCOS is a really common ovulatory disorder, it can be. So you're seeing this in your practice because you've written about it.
For sure. Yeah, those are probably the two most common conditions, I guess. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about them. They're quite different from each other. Actually, they're very, very different. And endometriosis, I would argue, is less a hormonal condition and more a bunch of other stuff, including immune. I mean, we could maybe come back to that, but
it's an everything condition. It is. And I'll share, that's where we gave several of your books away and people are so appreciative. We did the documentary film Below the Belt related to endometriosis and how it's misdiagnosed, underdiagnosed, and just all the suffering. And so it was just nice to introduce people to your work through giving out your... And so thank you for giving us those books so we could share them with the people that came to our workshop. So Can we start?
Thanks for sharing.
So I'd like you to talk about both. PCOS is one of my favorite things to treat because I think it's one of the things that responds well to the kind of medicine that you're practicing.
Yeah.
But I'd like to hear a little bit about the endometriosis because a lot of women may have it but don't know they have it. And so if you can talk a little bit about some of the symptomology to show that there's an issue there. And then I'd love to hear about your approach to polycystic ovarian syndrome as well.
Okay. So in my books, the angle I take, and I have a YouTube video about this. I've spoken about it at some length, actually, on my blog and on YouTube. And it's primarily, I would argue, a disease of immune dysfunction. It's in the territory of autoimmune disease, very close to that. It's influenced by hormones. And endometriosis is influenced by hormones, of course, as almost everything is, but it's very influenced by estrogen. Estrogen is just like gasoline on the fire of endometriosis. It's, you know, hard to have any active endometriosis lesions without estrogen being present. But my approach with my patients, because estrogen is very beneficial. So the medical approach, as you know, is to kind of shut down estrogen unless you're trying for pregnancy and then they try other strategies. But I feel like a way better approach is to dial down the inflammation, which usually involves dialing down the inflammatory reaction, the immune response, which a lot of it's to do, this won't surprise you, I think from a TCM lens, it's a lot to do with the gut microbiome. There's quite a strong degree of intestinal permeability with endometriosis, specifically, it sounds weird, but specifically some of the bacterial toxins, one called LPS, that's exiting the gut, basically ending up in the pelvis and inflaming those lesions. So that gives us a really good way in as natural health practitioners. We can fix the gut. A lot of it links with endometriosis. A lot of it links to a condition called SIBO or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which you've probably had guests talk about before. Plus, there's always going to be a genetic vulnerability. Endometriosis does seem to be quite strongly genetic. So some women just would never get endometriosis, no matter what kind of the state of their gut or state of their estrogen or anything. That's just never going to happen for them. You sort of have to have the system primed in a few ways, including having a certain, that autoimmune type of immune system or vulnerability. But the other thing that's going on with endo, I'll be honest, the last couple of years I've been talking to some other practitioners. There's a brilliant book coming by a Australian gynecologist. I'm going to give her a plug now. Her name's Peta Wright. You might be able to have her on your podcast one day. Her book's coming out later this year in 2023. And she's really raising some very interesting questions about just separating out pelvic pain, like acknowledging that pelvic pain and endometriosis kind of get sort of mushed together, but they're actually separate. And there's some real question marks around, for some women, what the presence of those endometriosis lesions, how significant that even is, like how much that's actually related to the pain. So there's some question that possibly, Peta Wright says, I hope I'm quoting her properly, but like she thinks some of these lesions in some women are just physiological, like a little bit of retrograde menstruation that ended up there, but the body's going to clean it up and it doesn't really mean anything per se. And yet other women can have quite active inflammatory lesions. So this is what I mean about endometriosis is a very complicated condition, and certainly it can affect fertility. I think its effect on fertility is a lot to do with just the inflammatory environment in the whole pelvis, not just the lesions themselves, but just that we talked about the follicles need a safe, happy environment to grow up in. When that whole pelvis is inflamed, that leads to poor egg quality and endometriosis. That's one of
we lose eggs, the quality is diminished. And we also, uterine receptivity becomes an issue as well.
For sure. Yep. And the implantation, like the endometrial lining becomes,
But what you've highlighted here, though, I really want to emphasize is the inflammation, but so much the gut health and through diet and lifestyle, stress and emotions can impact our gut microbiome. And I think even in the reproductive world, mainstream, conventional, they're starting to think about the microbiome, the vaginal microbiome and the uterine microbiome, at least, but it's becoming more of a understanding that it has a systemic effect on the body.
For sure. Yeah. There's a lot of research into endometriosis and the microbiome. And what I'm actually talking about is the pelvic microbiome, which is weird. Like we think of this, the gut microbiome, as you pointed out, there's the uterine microbiome for sure. Vaginal microbiome. There's actually a microbiome in the pelvic cavity itself. And women with endometriosis have, I think it's like 6 times higher levels of E. coli, a particular bacteria in the pelvis, which is
how do you address it then? Because we, you know, the conventional way there's obviously excision surgery. There is, you know, shutting down the hormonal system, like, you know, Lupron, drugs like that. What would be your approach if somebody has been diagnosed with endometriosis? What's kind of your approach for that?
Antimicrobials to start with, often. Yeah, I mean, it depends on the case, obviously, and certain antimicrobial herbal medicines you cannot use during pregnancy. So you'd have to sort of weigh that up and decide what treatment protocol you're going to do. But I'm curious again, because I know you are a TCM practitioner, so I can get you to weigh in. Like, I do use berberine, some of the berberine containing herbs that, from a TCM perspective, that, you know, that clears dampness, that clears some of that damp heat, which is microbial. Right. Basically.
Well, similar, like, because your colleague and friend, Dr. Kaylee McIsaac at our clinic at AccuBalance, we tag team, we integrate. And so she will do the antimicrobe, microbials. She does that, dietary changes. And this is after testing SIBO, you know, doing the gut microbiome test. And then we will use the herbal, but there's not like a one size fits all, as you know, in the Chinese medicine. It's how they're presenting. Because not all women diagnosed with endometriosis present the same symptoms either. And so we really look at how is the body presenting. And then it is, there's mind-body stuff, there's the supplements, there's the diet and lifestyle. Sometimes there's certain antibiotics and antimicrobes that you talked about.
And then it sometimes needs to be a pelvic therapy, like a physical therapy component to endo. It depends, because there's a whole pelvic floor spasm, and the nervous system and the pelvis can become quite overactive, you know, hyperactive. And so that's endo. And it's a big one.
And we're not doing an endo talk today, but we just wanted to talk. But I wanted to just because you're here, it's always good to tap into your knowledge. And then I'm just thinking like PCOS, for example, because was it when you were here, were you involved in some PCOS research or reviewing?
Good memory. So I was in Vancouver to meet up with Jarlyn Pryor, who we just mentioned.
She's the endocrinologist locally, retired.
She's a reproductive endocrinologist. Yeah, she's a researcher. Her research lab is just blocks away from you. And they've been running, I think they're close to finishing it, a clinical trial of what's called cyclic progesterone therapy for PCOS. So that's using natural progesterone, essentially, but they've been using, you know, the Permetrium, which is the prepared version of body identical progesterone. And one of the papers I wrote actually was with Jarlyn Pryor about kind of the mechanisms of progesterone for PCOS, because progesterone can have quite a nice anti-androgen, so testosterone lowering effect in women. And it also can promote ovulation by providing this sort of beneficial negative feedback to the hypothalamus, to the brain. And because, as you pointed out, one of the key features of PCOS can be anovulation, or just not regular ovulation. So, and that's important. Reestablishing ovulation is important for fertility, obviously, but also for general health, because it's by ovulating regularly, then women make more estrogen and progesterone. And then that in itself can help to relieve some of the androgen symptoms and even some of the metabolic symptoms. So, I mean, a PCOS, polycystic ovary syndrome, is kind of by definition the situation of androgen excess or excess testosterone in women when all other causes of androgen excess have been ruled out. It's always this kind of, it's sort of a, in that sense, it's kind of an umbrella diagnosis. It's like anyone who's got high androgens who doesn't fit into some other category gets thrown under the PCOS umbrella, which does mean different people can need different things. So it's perfect for naturopathic medicine and integrative medicine, because you can treat the individual, try to figure out. Yeah.
And the reason you're talking about the ovulation and how it's so important with in PCOS is because if you're not ovulating, then we have a lack of progesterone. Right?
Exactly.
So we're missing that. Yep. And do you find, like, a lot of the women that we'll see have been put on birth control pill? These aren't the ones that were trying to conceive, but that's how they were managing their PCOS-like symptoms. Is that a beneficial approach, or how do you see that from your naturopathic lens?
Well, my books are essentially all about how to come off the pill, how to not take the pill, like all the ways you can avoid pregnancy and treat menstrual symptoms.
What's the reason why you want to support women not needing or helping to come off the birth control pill? What is the bias there for you that you know that they may not be aware of that you have an interest in them not needing that?
Because women benefit from their own hormones, estradiol and progesterone, that are not the hormones in the pill. I mean, I think maybe I've come to realize a lot of people do, and even doctors do kind of think that the pill contains estrogen and progesterone. It doesn't. It contains sort of analogs of those hormones, but the big difference is in progestins, which are the synthetic sort of versions of progesterone used in the pill, and real progesterone. They have very different effects in the body, very, very different effects. In particular, one of the best examples of, there's two examples that illustrate how different the pill hormones or the contraceptive drugs are from real hormones is one is around breast cancer risk. All types of hormonal birth control carry a slight breast cancer risk. I don't like to overstate that. It's small, but it's mostly from the progestin. Whereas arguably progesterone, our own progesterone that we make or you can take as Prometrium, according to Professor Pryor, it probably reduces the risk of breast cancer. So that's one example of how they're different. The other way they're different is progesterone is really good for the brain, and progestins are not. And here's an example. The progesterone that we make with a natural menstrual cycle converts to what's called a neurosteroid. It's kind of like a neurotransmitter / hormone called allopregnanolone. People don't have to remember the name of it, but just know the brain loves it. It's really good for the brain. And the progestins in all types of hormonal birth control, none of those progestins convert to allopregnanolone. So when you put a young woman on any type of hormonal birth control, you've essentially robbed her of her own progesterone and replaced it with a medication that is not the same at all, especially for the brain. And that might be why, for example, we're starting to see some worrying signs in the research that especially young people, girls who are put on hormonal birth control as teenagers, grow up to have a triple the risk of depression and anxiety later in life, even once they stop the pill, because that formative years of, brain health is so important. And that's when we benefit from real hormones, estradiol and progesterone. I always talk about how this cavalier way that we're like, all women don't need their own hormones. Come on, we'll just put them on the pill and then they just like only let them ovulate when they're ready to have a baby. That would be like saying to men, oh, come on, you don't need your own testosterone. What are you worried about? We'll just suppress your testicular function and suppress your testosterone and replace it with this drug that's only kind of like testosterone, but mostly like estrogen. And it's probably going to cause depression and affect your brain development over your life. But don't worry, because that's what everyone else takes. That's essentially where we're at with the pill right now.
And that's why I wanted to talk to you. And I'm so glad you're writing your books. And so what would be some of the natural approaches then to help somebody with a metabolic disorder like polycystic ovarian syndrome?
Yeah.
You're using dietary tools.
Yeah. So PCOS responds incredibly well to natural treatments. And an answer to your previous question of why not take the pill for PCOS, because the problem with PCOS is that you're not ovulating and you potentially have insulin resistance. The pill suppresses ovulation and promotes insulin resistance. So it has done nothing.
So we got to say that again, because we even talked earlier about egg quality, how blood sugar regulation can impact egg quality. Yeah. And so you're sharing that if you go on birth control pill, that ovulation, it doesn't fix ovulation, even though you may be getting a bleed. It's not an ovulatory bleed. And the hormones that you are replacing do not have the same impact on the body as the bioidenticals. So your goal is to get them ovulating so they have their natural estrogens and progesterones.
Correct. And just to say again, because we know that the contraceptive drugs in the pill compared to our real estrogen and progesterone, those contraceptive drugs do seem to promote or worsen insulin resistance. And that kind of paradox has been known for a while. I've done a few papers about that. It's like, oh, wait, why are we giving medications essentially that cause insulin resistance to women that already have insulin resistance? It's not ideal.
And that was the best tool that conventional medicine had, right? So that's why they're doing it. But there are other paradigms or practices of medicine, like naturopathic medicine. And you guys address this differently. And so diet, there's supplements you do to help regulate sugar.
Yeah.
And so can you share a little bit?
The top supplement everyone should know about, I always feel like I'm doing an infomercial for it, is inositol.
I love my
myo-inositol.
I do it because I'm a little heavy in the waist, so I started taking it for that reason, because blood sugar regulation.
I'm taking it for sleep, actually. This is why I feel like I'm doing an infomercial for inositol. It does lots of things, actually. It's good for thyroid. It helps with intracellular signaling. So it gets right down into the nuts and bolts of kind of hormonal signaling for a few hormones. It enhances insulin sensitivity. It promotes ovulation. It's like inexpensive. It's safe when you're trying for pregnancy. This is why I feel like.
Do you ever use the D-chiral with the myo-inositol, or do you stick with the myo-inositol?
I have a podcast episode about that. So if anyone wants to check that out, you can put it in the show notes.
Yes. Let's give a shout out to your podcast so they know how to find it. Yeah. Do you know the episode number by chance or the title?
No, I don't. I've only honestly got like 12 episodes. So it's easy to find. It's somewhere in the middle. It's just inositol is in the name of the episode. And yeah, I was in researching that episode. I really was able to finally get my head around it. Like D-chiro, you need to be careful with D-chiro with PCOS. So compared to myo inositol, D-chiro inositol does promote insulin sensitivity. It's okay to have a little bit of it in there. But too much D-chiro can prevent ovulation. Yeah, so
the 40-to-1 ratio is what most of the companies.
40-to-1 is fine.
Yeah, that's what
you can either do 40-to-1, or you can do straight myo-inositol. Whichever is kind of easier and more accessible. I think that's fine. You just wouldn't want to do straight D-chiro, at least not for PCOS. So there's that. Yeah, there's
what else?
Zinc. Zinc is my other favorite one. Anti-androgen for women and. Cyclic progesterone therapy. So that's what
I got to tell you. One of my favorites. You didn't say one of my favorites. Yeah. So I'm going to check in with you. I bet you probably. So the myo-inositol sometimes with the D-chiro 40-to-1 ratio, and I love N-acetylcysteine.
Yes. Yeah. I prescribe it for a lot of things. Actually, I prescribe it for endometriosis as well.
Same. Yeah.
For some of its anti-inflammatory effects. Yeah, I think it's great. It can be a great supplement for lots of different things, for sure. So that's a good. Actually, PCOS can respond to lots of different. Strategies. Again, it can be very individualized for what's going on for the woman. And then there's the cyclic progesterone therapy, which we mentioned before, that Geraldine Pryor just probably finished a clinical trial on that. And one of the problems they had with recruitment for that trial, of course, women participants had to agree to not take the pill. They had to use cyclic progesterone instead of the pill. That was sort of the whole point. So I think they've finally finished it now and will hopefully publish those results, which will be great. To see. Well, the great thing about progesterone is it induces a bleed. So it can give you those withdrawal bleeds, at least at first. But unlike the pill, it actually promotes ovulation rather than suppresses it. So it's safe when you're trying. It's also, when you're trying for pregnancy, you can use it.
And it's because it's the cyclical. Like, if you're taking it, because you're not taking it all month long, you're taking it and having a break. And it's that cyclical use is what's going to help support ovulation. Yes?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is what, and I remember we do the cyclical progesterone often, and Kaylee's greatly influenced by Geraldine's work and from her connecting with you as well, how we use it. And again, the acupuncture, the supplements, it's just a really nice imbalance, metabolic disorder that I think responds to the diet, the supplements, the acupuncture, the cyclical progesterone. And have you found, because it's been my experience is, when you give somebody a birth control pill, as you shared, and then they come off of it for if they're diagnosed with PCOS back when they weren't trying to conceive, it doesn't correct it. The PCOS is right back to the ovulatory disorder. So it was like a Band-Aid effect. It wasn't fixing
massive symptoms. Yeah, it gave you withdrawal bleeds that meant nothing.
Right.
It didn't correct the underlying ovulation problem. It worsened it.
We've seen, witnessed, observed anecdotally that often when we work with women that are trying to conceive and we help them start get ovulating if they weren't or just have their ovulation more regular because they had such a delayed ovulation like every 45 to 60 days, that after having baby, that they continue to cycle. Like they don't need to go back onto treatment again. Do you see that?
Pregnancy can be a just massive hormonal reset. Makes sense. Like the whole system recalibrates it. Yeah, I've certainly seen that with patients where they've been maybe had a terrible time with PCOS, very worried about, having to go through it all again with their second baby. And I'll say, look, you may find after your first pregnancy and delivery that, boom, everything's okay now. It's possible.
So as we wrap up, I have another question then on this, because most of the women I see that have a diagnosis of PCOS or we help them determine that they have that diagnosis through their physician, through signs and symptoms, because if they start to ovulate, they're trying to get pregnant. We have that pregnancy, which you said is a great reset. So I have a question because not all the women you see are trying to get pregnant, but they have PCOS. If they're coming with irregular or non-ovulatory cycles and they go through your program, they work with you and they have 3 to 4 months of regular cycles, are you able to pull them off of the myo-inositols and all those things and cyclical progesterone? And does it hold or do they need to keep going the natural approach?
It's an excellent question. And the short answer is it will usually hold. I talk to my patients about getting the ball rolling, like getting the boulder rolling. Like once ovulatory cycles are going and robust, and as long as you're healthy, they should keep going. So I certainly had patients who use cyclic progesterone for like 6 months and then can come off it. It depends on the individual again, but no, I would say that you're not necessarily going to always need those supplements. If of all the long-term ones though, myo-inositol is a nice one because it's so good for everything, especially if someone has been kind of tending to insulin resistance and wants just a way to, you know, stay on top of that and keep their cycles going and keep their insulin sensitivity good, then I think that it could be quite helpful to stay on myo-inositol. But in answer to your question, no, there's a hope. Like they might just be able to find, well, I've just got normal cycles now. I'm ovulating monthly and everything is good. That's definitely possible.
So how do they find you? So website, Instagram, your podcast, your books, which I think are excellent. Can you and we'll put them in the show notes as well.
Yeah, I'm easy to find. Everything is Lara Bryden, so larabryden.com. And you can link to my podcast from there, the Lara Bryden podcast. And all my social media is at Lara Bryden. And my two books are Period Repair Manual and Hormone Repair Manual. And I don't know if I mentioned already, but I'm currently writing a third book, which is all about insulin resistance. So I'm very interested in that as a topic. This will be for women primarily. But yeah, there'll be lots about PCOS and perimenopause and postpartum is a time of potentially insulin resistance, unfortunately. So there's just lots to look at there. And it's a lot more than just, you know, it's not one size fits all diet. There's lots of things women can do. So
there we go. Dr. Lara Bryden, thank you very much for joining us on the Conscious Fertility Podcast.
Thanks, Lauren.
If you're looking for support to grow your family, contact AccuBalance Wellness Center. At AccuBalance, they help you reach your peak fertility potential through their integrative approach using low-level laser therapy, fertility acupuncture, and naturopathic medicine. Download the AccuBalance Fertility Diet and Dr. Brown's video for mastering manifestation and clearing subconscious blocks. Go to AccuBalance.ca, that's ACUBalance.ca.
Thank you so much for tuning in to another episode of Conscious Fertility, the show that helps you receive life on purpose. Please take a moment to subscribe to the show and join the community of women and men on their path to peak fertility and choosing to live consciously on purpose. I would love to continue this conversation with you, so please direct message me on Instagram at Lauren Brown Official. That's Instagram, Lauren Brown Official. Or you can visit my websites, laurenbrown.com and accubalance.ca. Until the next episode, stay curious and for a few moments, bring your awareness to your heart center and breathe.